And we're having a conversation today with Lawrence Hubgood, the pianist, who is going to be a couple of spots in Davenport this week. And I think he's also got a couple of dates in Noche and Des Moines coming up in April. And we'll have those dates here for you in just a minute. But Lawrence, thanks a lot for taking some time out today and having a chat.
It's my pleasure, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
For those who aren't familiar with Lawrence, he, of course, spent many years with Kurt Elling over in Chicago, 18-year experience with Kurt. We'll get touch on that and some other things. But let's start back at the beginning when you were, I think you started out actually working in classical music on the piano before your dad got a gig over at the University of Illinois, and you moved to Champaign-Urbana over there and kind of got your mind switched over to jazz. How did that happen while you were over there in Illinois?
Well, it's funny. That's cool that you asked about that. I had studied classically in Dallas, as you say. My dad was the chairman of theater at SMU in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And during that period of time, I also had sort of been introduced to blues music through jam sessions that happened at our church, actually. But I never had really tried playing jazz. It had been played in the house. My parents listened to Dave Brubeck and Duke Ellington and Oscar Peterson and Bill Evans, a little Miles Davis. But when we moved to Illinois, the logistics were that obviously I discontinued my lessons in Dallas 6 weeks before we moved or whatever. And then we got to Illinois, and my dad, it turned out, was keeping a very close eye on me, but he was being pretty cool about it. He didn't say a lot, but he just kind of noticed that I wasn't really playing. Hmm. I was 15 years old. That's a tough time to make a transition like that. And
sure.
So I was just sort of trying to adjust socially to the high school. But he was convinced, an artist himself, you know, he was convinced that music was my... was a talent that I should pursue seriously, but I wasn't playing, and I don't think I'd even asked about finding a piano teacher. And so he finally sort of said, "Well, you know, maybe this kid just isn't going to be a classical musician. He seems to like to improvise. He does it all the time. Maybe jazz lessons are the thing." And so I ended up taking jazz lessons with a young pedagogy professor on the music faculty at University of Illinois, and that was my introduction to jazz. And as soon as I got turned on to it, and I sort of no going back at that point, because it just sort of spoke to me, you know?
Sure. And that that proximity to Chicago, obviously kind of a natural thing that you would move kind of into Chicago first off to start your jazz studies, and that worked out pretty well. You got to work with people like Von Freeman and Fareed Hawk and Paul Wertico and all those great Chicago musicians. But
yeah.
How did you first hook up with Kurt Elling, and what was it about your relationship that it was able to last for so long?
I first met Kurt was actually living in a little one-room apartment. He was living in a little one-room apartment and moving furniture for a living while he tried to pay off his student loans from the University of Chicago, and was throwing himself assiduously at becoming a singer. And we basically met in conjunction with playing at the Green Mill Jazz Club.
Mm-hmm.
Which is still what I consider my jazz home. I've been playing there for almost 30 years now.
Wow, good.
We just started interacting, and we had a good... I always say that two heads are better than one, especially when the two heads bring different gifts to the table.
Yeah.
And so there was very little redundancy between what Kurt was good at and what I was good at, and so we were able to pool our resources and make a cool bunch of music happen. And from there, it was kind of a fluke, because he got signed with Blue Note at a time when the record companies were starting to actually see an advantage in keeping newly signed artists with their own sort of support network, aka a band. that you know, if a record company heard a really good demo and they said we want to put this out, whereas 10 years previously they might have been inclined to say, well, let's take this guy Elling and we'll put him with, you know, some people that are already really well known.
Mm-hmm.
And without getting too deeply into it, that can end up being problematic when it comes to consistency of personnel and touring and everything like that. And so my timing was nice in that Blue Note decided they liked me okay too, and kept me involved in what Kurt was doing. And so we ended up getting to make all those records. And the way that we evolved the material and the style of what we did just kind of progressed from one record to the next. And of course, the other sort of fluky thing is that the first record was nominated for a Grammy, and it's funny because by the time we got our 9th or 10th nomination, I would have people say something like, wow, man, 10 Grammy nominations, that's really something. I said, you know, it is really cool, but I'll tell you what's really amazing is not the 10th one, it's the first one.
Yeah, yeah.
because getting nominated for the very first record you make, it's kind of like getting a turbo boost, you know. It gets you visible very quickly, and it makes those subsequent nominations a lot more likely.
Sure.
You kind of get your foot in the door. So the fact that we were nominated for Close Your Eyes, which was his first record, was somewhat remarkable. And we just kept at it for all that time, and then eventually it was, the title of a familiar song, Time to Say Goodbye, Time to Go Explore in Different Directions, which is what we're doing now.
Absolutely, and it's I think it was 2007 you did this great duet disc with Charlie Hayden, who we love because he's first of all, he's an Iowa native, so he was, and that kind of piqued my interest there. How did you get involved with Charlie, and what was that project like, The Heart Dances?
Well, that was one of the coolest things I've ever done, the way that it happened is that I had been in touch with and making some records for a UK-based audiophile label called Naim, N-A-I-M.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, jazz people see that, and it's the first four letters of Naima, so they just sort of naturally go, oh, Naim. But it's actually just pronounced Naim. And I'd made several records for them. The connection to them was through one of my good friends in Chicago, who was an audiophile recording engineer, meaning he liked to make just room location recordings, very, very kind of old school, direct two-track stereo recordings, but in primo situations so that the sound was audiophile, mm-hmm. which is what these guys that have very, very expensive sound systems tend to be into. And it turned out that through Ken, there was a connection to this record label in the UK, and it turned out that also Charlie had done a number of records for them. And in fact, Charlie and Ken went back 30 years. They'd been friends for all that time. Meanwhile, then, kind of coincidentally, Charlie found out about Kurt's thing, and subsequently then got, you know, we met a few times. By 2007, Ken, he had been talking to Charlie about it for a couple of years, trying to say, you know, you and Laura should just do a duet record. And he finally agreed, and I flew out to California. One of the great things about that record is that by doing it in Charlie's backyard, we were able to not only, of course, make it very comfortable and easy for him, but also he used his famous Guillaume, the French luthier, I think Francois Guillaume. The Guillaume basses are there's only so many of them, and they're sort of the bass equivalent of Stradivarius.
Oh, okay.
And so that's the bass that he's playing on that CD.
Wow.
There's no amplifier, there's no amplification at all. It's just the bass and the piano and two microphones, and that's it. And we recorded for 2 days, and it was great. It was a fantastic experience. He was wonderful.
I bet. Another interesting project I was reading about you did with the poet laureate Robert Pinsky, who is a three-time U.S. poet laureate. That was a thing in 2012, I think, called Poem Jazz, which actually I think resulted in a couple of discs. What was that project like?
Well, and that's ongoing. In fact, I just performed with Robert out in California a couple times in the last couple of weeks.
Oh.
And we're planning the third CD. That was another collaboration that came about as a result of an introduction. A good friend of mine in he's a born and bred Hudson Valley guy, Nyack, New York, on the Hudson River up north of New York City. Richard Conley owns a combined record label and small independent record label and also publishing concern, publishes books. And Richard is, I mean, I could go on and on about Richard. I won't even try to get his CV on the table, but his accomplishments and the people that he knows, especially in the literary world, are quite astonishing. And so he knew Robert, and he knew that I had a history of playing with spoken word, a lot with Kurt. That probably was the most visible, but also had done so earlier with other people, and it all perhaps related back to the fact that I grew up in a theater family,
mm-hmm.
Which gave me a little bit more of a different kind of exposure to the written word than maybe a lot of jazz musicians have. So he just thought it would be a really good match, and he introduced me to Robert. And it's funny, Robert came to a gig that we did in Boston, and less than 2 weeks later, after having just met, we were in the recording studio making that first record. So we really got right to it, and we're still performing, six to ten concerts a year end up happening, and it's a lot of fun. He reads.
Mm-hmm.
But he kind of riffs on his poetry. He's sort of improvising himself. He'll put lines out of sequence. He'll repeat stuff. And he has a very musically rhythmic way of, he reads in a different rhythmic way when he's doing it to music,
mm-hmm.
than if he's just doing a poetry reading. And meanwhile, over the piano, I really just mostly improvise. It's what I call... it's what should be called, I think, thematic improvisation. I say that because one of the things I've learned is that a lot of people hear that word improvisation and they tend to go immediately to thinking, you know, sort of far-flung saxophone lines or something, that are very involved. And, of course, you can sit down and play something that sounds like a very simple song, and it might be improvised. So the approach I take with Robert is very... sort of song-like. I guess the obvious reference point is some of the stuff that Keith Jarrett has done over the years, where he'll sit down and play something. It almost sounds like a hymn or something like that, but
mm-hmm.
It's got a melody, and if you hear it, you might say, boy, have I heard that before? It sounds so sounds so familiar, almost like I've heard it before, and then it turns out he was just making it up.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I do behind Robert, and it's very fun. It's very edifying. A lot of it because audiences tend to universally sort of react by a collective, wow, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. I actually like this. we have a lot of fun.
Yeah. Speaking of the literary world, you're actually an award-winning journalist yourself. I know you picked one up for an article you wrote called The Art of the Trio for Jazz Times Magazine. Have you done a lot of that sort of thing, or was that a one-time thing?
You know, it's funny. It's funny you should mention that because I've got several ideas for articles that I've been thinking about contacting my friend Lee Mergner at Jazz Times and say, hey, here's three articles I really want to write. A lot of it's just the time, you know. I take writing pretty seriously, and I spend so much time now writing music, not the word.
Mm-hmm.
They're just constant deadlines in my life of things that music that have to be written either for myself, my own projects, or someone else, usually a singer that I'm working with. I'm actively working with two singers right now on their upcoming projects. And it's just a lot of hours writing music, and so it's hard to find time to write the word. But I have a couple of good ideas for things, and so I'd like to get back into that. That particular, The Art of the Trio record, that was kind of funny because Lee asked me to write that article was actually program notes for JVC Jazz Festival.
Oh.
But the deal that Jazz Times had done with JVC Jazz Festival was that all of the program notes that they commissioned to be written for the various acts that were performing JVC Jazz Festival that year, which was kind of a rotating festival happening all over the place, would be printed in an issue of the magazine. And so that also happened. And then at some point, I remember Lee called me up and he said, "Hey, how you doing? Have you, by any chance, gotten any sort of a call about an award?" And I said, "What are you talking about, Lee?" And he said, "Well, there's this journalism award that ASCAP gives called the Deems Taylor Award. And I, you know, every year we submit a certain number of articles that we have run in the magazine that year for consideration. And I threw yours in with that bunch." And I just kind of laughed. And I said, "Well, no, Lee, I haven't heard anything about a journalism award, and I don't expect to, but I'll let you know if I do." And we kind of had a chuckle about that and got off the phone. And it was the very next day that my phone rang, and I saw I was still living in Chicago, of course. I saw it was a 212 number, which is New York, and I was curious. I picked it up, and it's a guy calling to inform me that I had won the Deems Taylor Award for my article that I wrote. So it was pretty cool. Pretty cool experience going to New York and you know, accepting the award and making a little few comments. The event was held at Juilliard. It was fun. It was a cool thing.
Neat. You mentioned working with a couple of singers. Can you mention who you're working with now, or is that?
Well, I can mention one. The other one is a little bit of a secret.
Okay.
There's a great R&B singer from the San Francisco Bay Area named Cliff Payne. And he contacted me, and there's a certain style of arranging that I guess is sort of, you know, my unique way of going about that, that is best known in the material that I did for Kurt. What I can tell you is some of the projects that also reflect that style that are finished that I've put out recently. Most notably, a record I did for Lynn Records last year for the British singer Barb Younger. Are you familiar with Barb?
I've heard the name, yeah.
Yeah, I think in this country she's more associated with the cabaret circuit, which this is just my opinion, but I think that's a little unfortunate because she's a real jazz singer, you know, intellectually, in terms of musically, the way that she's able to, she never really sings songs exactly the same way twice. You know, she's a musical thinker and, a real jazz singer. And we did a really cool record called Shelter from the Storm. And Bob, as you probably know, but some of the listeners may not, one of the things that I've sort of specialized in is what I call updating the songbook. So many of the classic jazz treatments have been based on things by Cole Porter and Gershwin and Jerome Kern and Harold Arlen and Rodgers and Hart, you know, the classic song repertoire.
Sure.
From the 40s, 50s, 60s of the last century, but so much of the music by people like Carole King and Paul Simon and Sting and Stevie Wonder, the names go on and on, are also ripe for jazz treatment.
Absolutely.
And that was very much the kind of record that Barb wanted to make. You recognize the title, Shelter from the Storm, as a Bob Dylan song, mm-hmm. and that is indeed on there. And there are several original things on there, but mostly it's these revisitations and new treatments of more what we think of as pop tunes, but putting them into the jazz territory. And the other record that I did recently was for a Chicago singer named Tammy McCann. I think Tammy's performed over here,
mm-hmm.
In this area of the world. Great, soulful, fiery, a little everything. When Tammy, you get gospel and also classical elements to her voice, but she's a wonderful singer. We did a record called Love Stories that was a similar approach, except that all that repertoire was very classic jazz repertoire, like Green Dolphin Street and Lullaby of Birdland and Don't Explain and really classic jazz tunes, but with a twist, you know?
Sure.
So that's the kind of thing. Cliff Payne, the guy I mentioned who's in the Bay Area, he's a big Stevie Wonder, almost historian in a way.
Huh.
And so we're kind of focusing on a lot of Stevie tunes for his project. And then I'm going to be, you know, kind of doing my thing with him. And I expect we'll record out there probably.
Cool. We're talking with Lawrence Hobgood, who's going to be at the Holiday Inn at 6 o'clock this Thursday evening, and then he's got that great Sunday thing that the Redstone Room does on Sundays. He's playing at 6 o'clock, and I think they usually have some sort of a master class or something during the afternoon, I believe, too. I don't know if you're doing that.
I believe there is at 3 o'clock.
Okay.
3:30
sure.
In there, and then the trio will play at 6. I'm real excited. These two young musicians from Detroit that I'm going to be doing some extensive touring with in the coming months. This Quad Cities date is a little bit of a freestanding date. And they'll be with me in Des Moines, too. Same two guys.
Okay.
But they, when I talked to them, they said, well, no, we want to drive over. So they're driving all the way from Detroit just to play at the Redstone Room. And, you know, it's going to be really cool. Ben Ralston and Stephen Begehold are their names, the bass and drums.
Okay.
And that's going to be, it's going to be fun, I promise. It'll be a good show.
Because I know your new disc, your newest disc that we have, Honor Thy Father, has, you know, John Patitucci and Kendrick Scott, and I assume they probably wouldn't be traveling with you.
Yeah, you know, that's when I made that record, I knew that I wasn't going to have access to them for touring, but I wanted that. Those are the two guys that I just wanted to play with, and so I just went ahead and did it. And the next record I make, the personnel that are on it will be the people that I will at least try to use for touring. I have a regular New York trio, but those guys, Jared Schoenig is the drummer, and the bassist is an Australian import, I guess, Matthew Cloisy. And they're just busy as all get out. So I met these two young guys from Detroit. We did some playing last fall, and they really, boy, they're really great players. So they're kind of my Midwestern anchor at this point. Also, just one of the realities of the music business these days, more cost-effective.
Sure.
If you can have people, regional people who have, you know, learned to play your music and do so well and enjoy it. So that's kind of a model that you see any number of artists these days. It's quite a lot of green, if you will, to
yeah.
to be bringing a whole band on the road.
Absolutely.
All the time. So I've got a kind of a West Coast rhythm section now, and a Midwest rhythm section, and an East Coast rhythm section.
That's good to have. Man.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's great. I like playing with different people.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's really cool. Kind of challenges you, I suppose, and you're probably playing differently for each rhythm section, I would imagine. I mean, whatever they bring to it, I guess.
Absolutely. There is a very interesting sort of chemistry and stylistic temperament set of issues that that go with each grouping, it's a fascinating thing, really, and it's one of those things where I'd love someday to have an optimal situation. As I think of Herbie Hancock on a couple of occasions has gotten to have single evenings where he had different bands from over the years. Chick Corea has done this too,
right?
Where, like, in the course of an evening, you can hear three or four different configurations that artist was known for playing with. And it's really interesting to hear them one after the other and hear the different things that they get into. There's not an opportunity very often to be able to, as we say, is A-B something like that, compare directly two different sounds. But but it is true that each different set of personnel brings a slightly different or sometimes not slightly different, sometimes radically different color to what we're doing. So I enjoy playing with different people like that.
Well, and speaking of different colors, I know I was reading your newest disc, project that is on the way with your New York-based trio is also including a string quartet, which, of course, you did with the Coltrane and Hartman project, too. Is it called Tessitera? And is that
That's correct.
Coming out soon or yeah. in the works? Or?
Well, it's in the works. You know, these are very interesting times to be a musician. And the sort of the death knell of the compact disc has and related issues has made it so that whenever we're contemplating a new project, we're kind of asking ourselves, okay, all right, now exactly what do I want to do here? So with Tessitera, for a while I was thinking that I might instead, for similar budget, for making it happen, but I might try to do a live performance video of Tessitera if I could find the right venue and the right situation for doing that. And, you know, spare you the long, agonizing story, but I think I'm now back to saying, let's just go into the recording studio and make a record and maybe an opportunity to do the video type of thing will come out of that. So hopefully before another year has passed, I'll get that into studio. Part of the issue there is these other projects.
Mm-hmm.
The single project that I really shouldn't mention yet is for a major label. So that obviously takes some calendar priority.
Absolutely.
That's going to be a very cool thing when it happens. In the meantime, I have to figure out when I can do my own project.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing to be so busy, isn't it? In one way, I guess.
Well, you know, I really am blessed in the sense of being however you want to say it, but a high level player, and also a composer, arranger, orchestrator, because that's why I'm so busy. And all the years that I spent with Kurt, I learned my way around the recording studio, and I actually had started doing that before I ever even met Kurt. So that brings production capabilities into the picture as well. So it's kind of funny that the music business is as transformed and even challenging more than ever, and it is, and yet the number of people that want to do projects hasn't reduced from what I can tell at all. There's a lot of people that, more than ever maybe, that want to do projects, and they all need, almost all of them, need somebody that can do arrangements and help them put the project together and make it happen. So the multiple skill sets do come in handy, and as a result of that, I am very, very happy to be as busy as I am. It's real tough, tough business these days.
Absolutely. You know, I was reading your biography, and I was marveling at all the people you played with. But one of them stuck out quite a bit because he just passed away within the last month or so. Larry Coryell, you got a chance to work with Larry back in the day. Talk a little bit about Larry Coryell and your work with him.
Oh, well, that was just a wonderful set of circumstances that happened through Paul Wertico. When I moved to Chicago in 1988, I wasn't destined to meet Kurt until 93. So there was 5 years in there that I sort of, you know, made my own name in the Chicago scene, and didn't take too long for Paul and I to connect. Paul, of course, the great drummer who played with Pat Metheny.
Yep.
For, interestingly enough, almost the same number of years. He was with Pat for 17 years.
Wow.
I toured with Kurt for 18. So a little bit of a similarity there.
Yeah.
And Paul and I were playing a trio and also a couple of other projects together, and he knew Larry. And so we ended up doing, I think we did 3 Green Mill weekends, and we also played a festival up in Wisconsin. And the festival up in La Crosse, Wisconsin. We worked it out for Larry to come in as a headliner and then for us to play, you know, behind him or with him or however you say that. And it was, I mean, Larry was just an inspiration because he was just pure energy, man. He was just pure energy.
Yeah.
Great, great connective feeling in the ensemble playing with him. And, of course, he had chops like crazy.
Right.
And he was a great guy, fun guy, very relaxed guy. I was so sad when he passed last month because I can't remember the last time we spoke, actually, because it just had been a while.
Yeah.
I remember we sort of caught up on the phone a number of years ago, and then I hadn't seen him. Last time I heard him perform live was a show up in Boston maybe about 8-9 years ago. But that's a big loss.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like we're losing a lot of people these days. Somebody moves on to the next situation.
Sure.
If you want to put it that way.
every month
we're losing somebody. So.
We keep getting those generations though. Keep coming behind you, and there's a lot of talented.
That's right.
There's a lot of talented folks coming up too.
Boy, is there.
It's Lawrence Hopgood, and he is at the Holiday Inn at 6 o'clock on Thursday evening, the Redstone Room, for a performance at 6 o'clock in the evening, and he'll be doing some other things during the day, as they usually do there. And April 14th and 15th at Noche over in Des Moines, really nice new jazz club they have in the capital city there. Now, are you going to be doing mostly things from the new CD, Honor Thy Fathers, or what kind of things can people expect to hear from you when you come?
That is the focus. So Honor Thy Fathers is every track is a dedication to some influence, both a couple, several instances, including my own father, personal influences in my life, but also the great heroes like Oscar Peterson and Wayne Shorter that have met Nat Cole, who have been influences on me from afar, from mm-hmm. recordings and just listening to and studying their music. So there are a number of arrangements and pieces that that just couldn't fit on the record. You never can put everything that you'd like to on a record, at least
yeah.
that's my experience. So that adds some of the repertoire. And then there are a few other more recent things that I've written that we're doing. But it definitely is focusing on that repertoire. It's a fun show. It's in a lot of cases, it's pretty intricate writing of the main melodies and the main sections before we start improvising, and a lot of nice grooves and you know, some things that are familiar but rendered in a different way, we have a lot of fun playing it.
Well, that's great. It'll be, again, the Holiday Inn in Davenport on Thursday. It's the Redstone Room Sunday, both of those in Davenport, both of those at 6 o'clock, and then in April at Noche in Des Moines. And it's certainly been a pleasure chatting with you, Lawrence Hopgood, and really enjoying all the stuff you've put out so far, and certainly looking forward to a lot more in the years ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I just want to, if I may, I just want to, mm-hmm. I don't want to forget to say what a great thing the Quad City Arts that has brought me in here to spend some time this week. It's a fantastic organization, and I refer to it out in the world pretty frequently because there are people out there that don't know. You know, if you say Quad Cities, they're like, "What is that exactly? Where is that?" And I'm like, "Oh, let me tell you, it's a very cool place." And amongst other things, they have this really, really fantastic arts organization. So, you know, kudos to them for keeping it going, and I just think it's a really great thing that they're doing.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Lawrence, and good luck in your future.
All right, Bob. Thank you.
You bet.